This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear what happened to the plans by a French multinational company to build a light rail tramway system linking to illegal Jewish settlements.
The boycott, divest, and sanction movement is taking effect. Veolia Transport System, bowing to pressure, has abandoned the project.
We'll talk with an employment and labor attorney about the Supreme Court's recent decision in Ricci v. DiStefano.
5-4, the Supreme Court moved the goalposts. It's harder now to prove racial discrimination in a fire department.
Stay with us. Michael, what's happening on the torture prosecution front? Has there been a turnaround recently?
Well, you know, to many it appears that there may have been. The last week was filled with news articles in which Holder is quoted as saying, although not directly but indirectly, is that he's thinking about appointing a prosecutor, a line prosecutor at first, maybe a special prosecutor, but a line prosecutor to look into allegations of the Bush administration regarding torture.
And just to let our audience know, what is a line prosecutor versus a special?
Good question. A line prosecutor is someone who would be in Holder's office, not a special appointment. A special prosecutor would be technically more independent and able to pursue his or her own work without as much interference by the Attorney General Holder. But so this was a pretty big revelation in a certain way. I mean, this is something that a lot of us, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the ACLU, have been working on for a long time to try and get a prosecutor appointed to investigate torture. Everybody's been laughing at us, said it's ridiculous, we'll never do it, even liberals. And now all of a sudden, a number of newspapers are reporting that within the next few weeks, he may very well appoint some kind of prosecutor for an investigation. But as usual in these kind of cases, we don't know yet, and it's all in the fine print. And if you read what Holder has said, not he himself, but the leaks have said carefully, that he has said, I'm not going to look into the core of the so-called torture conspiracy. I'm not going to look into the legal memos or the people who authorized it. I'm only going to examine, or he may only examine, those people who went beyond what the legal memo said or what the orders said. So if they said you had to waterboard a person in a certain way, and the person was waterboarded for an extra 5 minutes, that person might be able to be prosecuted. Now, I think that's, of course, the silliest thing I've ever heard, because what it does is it leaves intact the core of the torture program, and only people who exceeded the core of the torture program will even be looked at. But again, I want to caution, we don't know if that limitation will be on it, but my guess is that it will, because both President Obama and Eric Holder have said repeatedly that the legal memos essentially provide a defense. But it'll be hard to know whether they can really limit a special prosecutor or a prosecutor to that extent, although they will try. Apparently, according to the articles, and you never know what's fluff here, Holder was initially against any kind of prosecutor. Then he read the legal memos that were released by President Obama about waterboarding. That was one thing that began to change his mind. And now there's two other documents that the public is awaiting to see. One is the Office of Professional Responsibility report on the legal memos and the people who wrote them. And apparently that's very hard-hitting. It's been sitting around for 3 or 4 years, and it hasn't been released. It's on Holder's desk, but apparently it really shows that the lawyers were deeply involved in the construction of the torture program. So that's one document in addition to the memos that is pushing Holder in that direction. And the second document is the CIA report from 2004 on interrogation methods. And that again is being held up. The ACLU has requested that. It's been held up week after week. It's now slated for the end of August to be released in a redacted form, probably very redacted. But again, I think what that CIA report will demonstrate is that whatever the instructions were about torture, and they were bad enough, that the CIA people and others went way, way beyond those instructions. And I think Holder is saying, you guys may have a legal defense to some of this, but not to all of it.
Just to go back on the Office of Professional Responsibility reports, now that was under the Bush administration. It came out 2 to 3 years ago. What kind of clout does that report usually have? Meaning, what is the function of that office?
Every executive office has some kind of inspector general or professional responsibility. In the case of the OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel, it's called the Office of Professional Responsibility because it concerns the ethical obligations of the lawyers who work for the government. And so one thing that report apparently does, it doesn't look at whether there were criminal acts, but what it does do is whether there were ethical violations. And when that report is issued, if it's issued in a either unredacted or unmodified form, and of course over the last 2 or 3 years, Heidi, they've been modifying it like crazy probably, but apparently it will recommend the report be given to the various bar associations around the country for possible professional disciplinary proceedings against people like John Yoo. That's my guess.
Speaking hypothetically here, could the Center for Constitutional Rights or other legal organizations file suit for enforcement of that?
You know, I think the National Lawyers Guild has actually filed some ethical complaints against some of the lawyers. And those are generally, you can file them, generally they're kept secret, not the filing necessarily, although it can be, but the actual disciplinary proceeding are kept secret. If they're dismissed off, there's really not necessarily much of an appeal, but there have been a number filed both by...
Our Bay Area chapter filed them.
Right, as well as by a group called the Velvet Revolution, which has also filed, I think, a dozen or so of these ethical complaints against lawyers. That's all without the OPR, Office of Professional Responsibility report. When that report comes in, I think it will increase the pressure to charge these lawyers with ethical violation. And, of course, criminal violations are hopefully around the corner. So in some ways, you know, it's hard for me to say. My basic position on the Holder leaks about him appointing a prosecutor are that he's probably doing it in a very restrained way to only go after people who went beyond the core of the torture, and that really protects the high-level torturers. And so that's not good. And he's also probably doing it to muddy up the European prosecutions, particularly the Spanish prosecutions. The Spanish government has asked the American government for a result by early fall to report on whether they are pursuing prosecutions or investigations of high-level Bush administration officials. If they are, then the Spanish will defer their prosecutions. So this may all be even about that, just getting the Spanish off their backs. In the end, it's still going to take a lot more pressure to get this government to actually look up the chain of command, go after Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Tenet, and the lawyers. Even under the current Holder proposal, if we can even call it that, it sounds to me like it's going to be some CIA guys who went beyond what the instructions were on things like waterboarding. I gave some examples. I said to someone who interviewed me on this, I said, well, are they saying that if you bend someone's arm behind their back and break one bone because that's authorized, that's okay, but if you do it again and break two bones, then it's not okay? Well, that's what they're saying. In this next segment, we want to talk about a French multinational company, Veolia Transport, which was part of a consortium that was to build a light rail tramway linking West Jerusalem to the Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. The good news is Veolia Transport has decided to abandon the project in the face of the incredible and intense protests from the BDS Boycott, Divest, Sanction national campaign or worldwide campaign to get groups, companies, etc. to stop dealing with Israel. The victory came after years of coordination by the French, Dutch, and British groups, as well as the Palestinian BDS National Committee. Today we're joined by Omar Barghouti, founding committee member of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. Welcome, Omar, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Tell us, what is the Boycott, Divest, Sanctions movement?
In a nutshell, it's a movement based on the basic Palestinian rights, on our fundamental rights to live without occupation, without colonization, without apartheid, and with our refugees returning to their homes of origin, as stipulated in UN resolutions and international law. This is a rights-based approach that is a form of civil nonviolent resistance that aims at isolating Israel and turning it into a pariah state, as South African apartheid was, in order to attain those basic Palestinian rights.
Tell us a little bit about how the campaign works and what your goals are.
Well, the goals, as I said, is ending the three forms of Israeli oppression, which are the occupation and colonization, the system of racial discrimination in Israel, as well as the denial of Palestinian refugee rights. These three rights correspond to the three main segments of the Palestinian people. Many in the U.S. might think that the Palestinians are those who are in the West Bank and Gaza only, including Jerusalem, possibly. But the truth is that though Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza are a tiny minority of the people of Palestine. The majority of the Palestinians are refugees who were ethnically cleansed in 1948 by Zionists in the process of creating or establishing the State of Israel. And they remain in refugee camps all over the world, including inside the West Bank and Gaza. The way the campaign works is that it has a solid support base in Palestine, among Palestinians everywhere, in the 1967 occupied territory, among Palestinians in Israel, as well as among Palestinians in exile. It is endorsed by almost every main political party, organization, union, network that is working among Palestinians. So we have a leadership that is a coalition of all these main associations and unions, and we communicate with solidarity movements, who are our partners across the world, our goals and our themes, and they decide on their tactics and how best and most effectively to contribute to our BDS campaign.
Omar, for listeners who aren't familiar with how a boycott, divest, sanctions movement works, explain what you're asking people to do. What are the mechanics of the campaign?
Okay, for the older generation, they might understand what this is from the South African experience. For the younger generation who are not very familiar with the South African anti-apartheid movement, a boycott is mainly an individual decision to boycott a service or to boycott a product or to boycott a company that is profiting from Israel's occupation or from its oppression, other forms of oppression of the Palestinian people. For example, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation has launched a couple of years ago now, boycott of Motorola because of Motorola's complicity in supporting the Israeli army, the occupation army. The main communication systems in the Israeli army are provided by Motorola. So that's at a basic boycott level. But also people have boycotted Israeli products like vegetables and fruits in Europe. There's a big boycott of Israeli produce in Europe. In the U.S., there's a starting boycott of Ahava and other Israeli companies, as well as American companies involved in the occupation and oppression of the Palestinians. The most basic form, and it's a personal moral decision. Divestment is more an institutional decision. When you pressure a university like Hampshire College, which was the first university in the world to divest from companies profiting from the Israeli occupation, divesting from companies that make their profits through the oppression of the Palestinians, through the Israeli injustices. Churches, unions, and others can be pressured and lobbied to divest from companies that are benefiting Israel and maintaining its occupation and oppression. Sanctions is the most difficult, and it is no coincidence that it comes last in the BDS order, because sanctions is a boycott by states. It's a decision by states, by governments, by sovereign governments, to isolate another government, as they've done with apartheid regime at the very end of the anti-apartheid struggle. So while the boycott movement for South African freedom started in the 1950s, actual sanctions were struck against the South African apartheid regime by the UN and later by Western governments in the late 80s. So it took a long, long time for the S part of BDS to start working in the South African case. We expect the same in the Palestinian case.
So no movement yet on the sanctions?
Minor sanctions. Of course, most Arab countries do not maintain, and most Muslim countries do not maintain diplomatic relations with Israel, so that's a form of sanction. Bolivia and Venezuela pulled out their ambassadors during Israel's massacre in Gaza this last January. So there are some sanctions, but they're not enough. The Dutch Labor Party has threatened Israel with sanctions if its government continues to torpedo the peace process, so-called peace process. Beginning of a talk of sanctions, the Liberal Democratic Party in Britain has talked about suspending the EU-Israel Association Agreement. So there's an increasing adoption of the language of sanctions, but we do not expect anything on the ground.
You had a recent victory with Veolia. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, Veolia and Alstom are two huge French conglomerates that are involved in more than 55 countries with major public works projects. They are both involved in a consortium that is building and will run the so-called Jerusalem Light Rail, which is a project that aims at connecting illegal Israeli colonies or settlements with Jerusalem. So this project, because it connects colonies and renders services to colonies, it's considered a black and white violation of international law.
Omar, explain a little bit about what an illegal settlement or colony is for people who don't know.
According to the UN, and even the U.S. government, Israeli settlements, Jewish-only settlements built on occupied Palestinian territory, the 1967 occupied territory, are considered illegal. According to international law, for an occupying country to move part of its population to live on the occupied territory is considered a war crime. It's absolutely illegal. It's a colony that's occupying Palestinian land, and it's a very aggressive colony that is the basis for the occupation. It's a military base. It's a base for settlers who usually attack Palestinians, confiscating more Palestinian land, stealing the water resources of the Palestinians, cutting Palestinian trees, and doing all kinds of very nasty colonial acts. So Veolia and Alstom were involved in this Jerusalem Light Rail, which is an illegal project. In November of 2008, Palestinian civil society and European civil society got together in Bilbao, in the Basque country in Spain, and launched a derail Veolia and Alstom campaign as a BDS action. We focused on Veolia because it's a huge target and it's working in so many countries in public works. So public pressure can work with Veolia. What we did, we have many partners who might not completely endorse the BDS call that Palestinian civil society issued in 2005, but they agree with us on the general guidelines of the BDS movement. The Church of Sweden, for example, and its major NGOs were involved in the derail Veolia in Stockholm, in Melbourne, Australia, most recently, in Bordeaux, France, in West Midlands, England, and in Tehran, Iran. In all these cases, there was a lot of pressure on public officials to not allow Veolia to take the major public works contracts. In each country, it was a different kind of contract. Altogether, Veolia lost $8 billion worth of contracts, mainly due to the boycott movement. So BDS did work quite well in the anti-Veolia campaign. This led Veolia to announce indirectly that it is withdrawing from the Jerusalem Light Rail project. It has not withdrawn yet. It's a very complicated technical process to withdraw, and it requires the Israeli government approval, but it has at least announced that it can no longer take the losses that it's sustaining and it was withdrawing.
What's the impact of this victory on the movement?
The impact has been enormous. It has energized BDS campaigners all over the world. BDS campaigns are starting in countries that we've never reached before, like India, Malaysia, Indonesia, Brazil, it's really growing, Venezuela, and so on. Campaigns, already existing campaigns, were extremely heartened by this victory. It was really almost unexpected. It came a bit too early for us. We expected that we're in it for the long haul. We will pressure Veolia for a couple of years until it bows to pressure. We did not expect the campaign to work so effectively in such a short period. It told us a very clear message that we should never censor ourselves. We should never limit our ambitions. In the BDS movement, we take on whatever target there is. If it's committing illegal acts, if it's involved in human rights violations and international law violation, we'll take it on. We will campaign against it. And now we've proven that with large networks and big alliances all over the world, we can really hurt those big conglomerates as well.
Omar, that's just a really beautiful statement. And I agree, you never should self-censor or limit what your goals are. And I think that's what you did here. Now that they apparently are going to pull out, is there an alternative for the Israeli government to use? What's going to happen to the project?
Veolia announced that it would sell its 5% share in the consortium running the Jerusalem Light Rail. However, according to its contract, with the consortium's contract with the Israeli government must approve the sale to any third party, which is not an easy process. Other companies that wish to buy the 5% that Veolia is selling will think twice now after our victory against Veolia, because we'll run after them. Alstom, which is the second big partner in this consortium, is already considering what to do, because it has a bigger share in this consortium than Veolia, and we're already working to derail Alstom as well. We're trying to pressure the governments of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Iran, as well as many other countries that have Alstom projects, and Alstom has projects in the billions in the Arab countries especially, we are going to pursue them until they've withdrawn as well. So we have no idea what will happen on the ground, who will buy this share of this consortium.
The building of the light rail tramway linking the illegal settlements to West Jerusalem is a method of legitimizing the illegal colonies and expanding Israel's tentacles into occupied Palestine.
Absolutely. And that's why it was such a black and white issue. It wasn't a gray area where people had to think twice. Is this project really illegal? It is 100% illegal by any definition. And we've consulted lawyers in Britain, in the Netherlands, as well as here in Palestine. And the verdict was very clear. This is a 100% boycottable case. Lawsuit against Veolia in the French courts, which is very important to mention, a leading French NGO that supports Palestinian rights called AFPS has taken Veolia and Alstom to court in Nanterre in France. The legal suit is continuing to this date, but the preliminary results are very promising as well. Veolia and Alstom tried to throw the case out of court, arguing that the French court had no jurisdiction because this is a project in a sovereign country. The court, the French court, argued that this is not acceptable defense because Israel is not the sovereign in the occupied territories. It's an occupying power. And therefore, in East Jerusalem, in occupied East Jerusalem, as well as the colonies, Israel is not the sovereign. Second, the court argued this is a violation of international law, and therefore every court in France has the mandate to take a decision on this case. They have not taken a decision yet, but the case is continuing, and we're winning little by little. The public awareness level, we already won. There's so many people who know what Veolia and Alstom are doing, and they're accusing them of violating international law.
What is the Israeli government reaction to the Veolia pullout and the BDS campaign?
The Veolia pullout, we did not see much of a reaction from Israel. It was very hush-hush. And that was very intentional. They decided to keep everything off the record and to deal with it very privately and very secretly. We have no idea what deliberations are happening and what negotiations are happening, but Israel is running mad about this campaign and the increasing effectiveness of this campaign. But for the last 4 years, and now we just celebrated the fourth anniversary of the BDS campaign, and the fifth anniversary of the International Court of Justice ruling against the Israeli wall in the occupied territories as illegal, Israel has not yet developed an effective weapon to counter the civil, nonviolent weapon of the Palestinians. They really have tried every trick in the book and have failed miserably. They tried initially the charge of anti-Semitism. They tried all kinds of nonsense charges against the campaign. But the campaign is very universalist in its appeal. It's based on human rights. It's against all forms of racism, including anti-Semitism. So it did not work. Plus, there's a disproportionately high number of conscientious Jewish citizens in the leadership of the BDS campaign in several Western countries, like the U.S., Canada, Britain, and France. It's a really very high number of Jewish citizens in the leadership of the BDS movement. And we're not talking about very fringe elements in the Jewish community. We're talking about very established intellectuals, academics, and activists. And when people like Naomi Klein and other main figures, John Berger, and other main Jewish figures around the world, intellectuals, join the BDS campaign, this anti-Semitism charge looks weaker and weaker by the day. So Israel has not yet invented an effective weapon to counter it, actually.
Omar, are you speaking to us from West or East Jerusalem?
I'm speaking from near East Jerusalem.
What's the reaction inside of Israel among the citizenry been to the BDS campaign?
In general, there's a panic, especially at the academic and cultural boycott. The first shocks came when the British Academic Union adopted the boycott back in 2005. And under intensive bullying and intimidation and intellectual terror, they were forced to reverse after 34 days. But then they adopted it again, and every year ever since, they've adopted some form or another of the boycott, even sometimes without using the B word, to avoid the threat, the real serious threat of lawsuits by Dershowitz et al. But the general Israeli citizenry, especially the Jewish Israeli public, has been in panic at every success of the BDS movement. I'll give an example. After Gaza, it was announced recently that the Israeli Industrialists Association, I don't know the exact name, announced that its losses due to the boycott after the Gaza massacre was about 20%, a 20% decrease in Israeli industrial exports to the world. The agricultural losses have been enormous, but we don't have any figures to give us an idea the scope of the loss of Israel's agricultural exports to the world. We know in Europe from first-hand experience that Israeli produce is rotting on the shelves. More and more Europeans are not buying Israeli produce, and they're seeing Israeli products in general as tainted with Palestinian blood, especially after Gaza. And this is the exact same image that the South African anti-apartheid movement was able to finally forge in the minds and hearts of the Western publics back in the 1980s.
Omar, if people want to participate in the BDS movement, and whether on a larger scale or smaller individually at the grocery store, how would they be able to identify which companies are participating in the Israeli occupation or benefiting from the Israeli occupation?
Okay, there's some intuitive ways, but the best way is to organize, is to join an existing campaign, and there's so many. I mean, it's mushrooming. There's so many campaigns doing BDS all over the U.S., including after Gaza, several important Jewish groups, not just American Jews for Just Peace, even Jewish Voice for Peace, which is, I guess, more mainstream or larger national Jewish group in the U.S., they've adopted some measure of BDS. So it's much easier now to identify with an existing BDS campaign. But at a basic level, Israeli products start with a barcode 729. On every product, there's a barcode. If the barcode starts with a 729 digit, this means it's a product of Israel.
I did see that there was a de-shelving supposed to happen at maybe one of the stores, Whole Foods or something, and I realize now what you're saying. Because it starts with the barcode 729, you can take, what, Israeli olives off the shelves, whatever there is, right?
Yes, exactly. It's not just Israeli companies, but also American companies that are complicit in maintaining the occupation. As I said earlier, a very easy target is Motorola. Motorola is extremely guilty in, it's completely complicit in the Israeli violence and injustices and oppression by supplying telecommunications equipment to the Israeli army. So it's directly implicated in the crimes being committed against us. And Motorola, mobile phones, there's so many other choices. People can easily boycott Motorola and identify their products. But there are also several other companies, like Pampers, like Disney, and several others. And there's good research on the net that people can access easily. There's a big campaign, Boycott Israeli Goods campaign, that's a British campaign. It has lists that support Israel or support the Israeli occupation. There's an Israeli website called whoprofits.org, as in who profits from the occupation, whoprofits.org. They identify companies and what exactly those companies are doing, as well as in a dump, waste dump in the West Bank used for dumping settlement waste. And this is absolutely illegal. Plus, Veolia is involved in a bus line that serves the settlements as well.
Now that you have the victory against Veolia, who's the next primary target?
I think it's time to hit Motorola hard.
Well, Omar, this has been a fantastic interview, and we really appreciate you joining us. We hope to have you back on Law and Disorder. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Omar, thank you. And thank you for all your work. It's really remarkable.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Last month, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in Ritchie v. DiStefano that a group of white firefighters and one Hispanic had been discriminated against when the city threw out a 2003 promotion exam. African-American firefighters had scored lower than required to get promoted. The higher-scoring white firefighters said the decision was unfair and compared the city's throwing out the exam to reverse discrimination. The High Court, in reversing 30 or 40 years of discrimination law, declared that the white firefighters in Connecticut were unfairly denied promotion because of their race. In doing so, it not only ruled against the minorities, but it also overturned Supreme Court nominee Judge Sotomayor's earlier ruling. Joining us to discuss this is employment and labor attorney Richard Levy. Richard Levy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be here.
Now, our listeners don't know, but Richard and I have had years of litigation on and off, Richard being the main litigator, on Title VII discrimination cases, and we're co-counsel with the center. Richard is co-counsel on the case against the New York City Fire Department. And we really brought Richard on to discuss a new Supreme Court case actually concerning firefighters, Ritchie v. DiStefano, that was decided a couple of weeks ago. And I, as a Title VII lawyer at one time, can't even understand the Supreme Court decision. So, Richard, why don't you start? What happened in the Supreme Court? Was it a big deal? It was 5-4. Sotomayor got reversed, who was a circuit judge. What happened here?
Well, since you mentioned Sotomayor, maybe I should just spend 10 seconds pointing out one thing about Sotomayor, since the right seems to be attacking her in light of this reversal by the Supreme Court. There were a lot of judges considered this question, the question of which when it is that an employer can set aside a test, a hiring test or a selection procedure, because it has adverse impact on a racial minority group. That's what happened in this case. Let's talk about this particular case and what the facts were. In this case, the city of New Haven gave a test for promotion firefighters to positions of lieutenant or captain in their fire department. And the results of the test were that whites passed both exams roughly at twice the level of blacks and Hispanics. The city looked at those results and said, gee, that's doesn't look good. That's really a problem. And we should reconsider whether this is a valid test to be using when it has this kind of a bad or adverse impact on minority officers in the department. And they held a series of hearings or meetings of their civil service board to determine if they should, in fact, take steps to set aside this test or whether the test was good enough and it should be certified. And they concluded at the end of those hearings that the test was not as good as it could have been, that it didn't or might not meet the requirements of the law to pass muster under Title VII, the Civil Rights Act, that it might be a discriminatory test, and they would most certainly be exposed or probably exposed to litigation over the question of whether the test was fair. And so they concluded after speaking to experts and after holding a number of hearings that they would not certify the test. As a result, a group of white firefighters backed by their union sued the city and said, no, no, you're now discriminating against us, the white firefighters, by not using this test that we had studied for and we did better than the blacks and Hispanics, but that doesn't prove that the test was bad. In fact, the practical effect of this certifying this test was that no black or Hispanic would have moved, at least in the foreseeable near future, into any of the job openings that existed. So that's the background on the test.
Di, you have any questions about that?
From what I understand, that this test was the sole basis on which promotions were to be given. Is that correct?
That's right. The test had two parts. It had a written component and an oral component. And the relationship was that the written counted 60% and the oral counted 40%.
Past performance in the field was not at all a factor.
It was not a factor that was discussed at all in the decision of the court, and as far as I know, was not a factor. I think they based it solely on the exam results. Now, there may have been some prerequisite to taking the test.
Was this test valid before approved passive validity test before they took the test?
It wasn't subjected to any validity analysis, apparently, before the test was given.
Which is to say we don't know if it really measured firefighting skills. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, that it was created in a way that was purportedly designed to measure firefighting skills. But what critics of these kinds of tests have pointed out is that you can't really measure the most important firefighter skills, particularly on written tests. Written tests, in the first place, tend to measure written comprehension more than they measure anything else. The thing is that to be a firefighter or to be a supervisor in firefighting, if you ask people what's important, they will tell you that there are a number of things that are very important, and it will not generally include at all how well you do on a written multiple choice test. They will tell you that it's important to be courageous, to have integrity, to be physically strong, to be clear in your spoken ability because you have to give instructions. You need to be a team player. You need to be cooperative. You need good judgment. And these multiple choice tests don't test for that.
So would it be fair to summarize this to say, here we have a test that wasn't necessarily validated to prove that it would get you better supervisors, and then you had an impact in which it passed white firefighters much more than black and Hispanic firefighters.
Right, and by definition, that's what creates a potential violation of Title VII. Title VII has a standard that says you have to look at exams that are neutral on their face, but not neutral in their outcome, that have a disparate impact on a racial group. When that occurs, the city or the employer has a high burden to establish that using that particular test is required by business necessity. They must do it to function decently. And that test, of course, was not passed in advance. I mean, that standard was never established. And what the city did after they gave the test, what New Haven did, is they said, you know, when we look at this test and we look at what we've used to measure supervisory capacity, we may well not be able to pass that business necessity standard.
We can't prove that this test is going to really be necessary to get supervisory firefighters.
Right. And we will have to expose ourselves to other litigation by minority groups if we were to certify this test when it had this terrible outcome in terms of minority promotions, which was a zero.
So that's a pretty clear explanation, I think, Richard. Now, what happens in the Supreme Court when they get this?
Well, the Supreme Court raises the following question. They say, look, you can't discriminate against whites, and you can't discriminate against minorities. They agree, the Supreme Court agrees that there is clear adverse impact here. And nobody has questioned that at any level in this exam. And what I mean by clear adverse impact is it very plainly, the test had a different outcome for black and Hispanic test takers than it did for whites. They just did much more poorly on this test. So everyone agreed to that. And that is sometimes referred to as the first prong of the discrimination test. So the Supreme Court says, okay, so there is adverse impact, but you can't just throw out a test because blacks don't do as well or Hispanics don't do as well. That alone would not be fair because suppose it's a really good test. Suppose it's a test that's fair and suppose it's a test that really is necessary for job performance. Well, if you then throw it out just because some blacks or some Latinos do worse, you're really discriminating against all those people who took the test and did well, and the test is absolutely necessary to perform the job. So the Supreme Court said, well, what should the standard be? Now, here's where this thing gets involved, because the Supreme Court changed the standard here. They set up a new standard that had never existed before for this kind of decision-making by an employer.
When we say the Supreme Court, 5 of the 9 justices,
yeah,
in a 5-4 decision.
Yeah, it's a very important point that This was a bare majority, and it was the decision was written by Kennedy, but it really reflects a very extreme right-wing group of justices who are changing a standard. And what they have enunciated in this case for the first time is that the employer cannot set aside that test, even when it clearly works to the disadvantage of blacks and Latinos or other minority groups. Cannot do it, can't set it aside, unless he's got a strong basis in evidence. That's the quoted phrase from the decision. He has to have a strong basis in evidence that the test itself is not valid, inadvertently, but nonetheless discriminates against a minority group. We don't want those tests to be used. So the statute and the EEOC and the government and the courts have consistently agreed that it is desirable for employers to voluntarily change their selection procedures to be more fair, to not discriminate, to use criteria that don't discriminate and that really relate very strongly to the job performance that's required. So voluntariness has been an important catchword of Title VII. You don't want every question to be resolved by a lawsuit. You want employers to have a reasonable degree of latitude to change and get rid of tests that apparently discriminate against individuals. Now, this test, there was no question about the statistical outcome. So what the city did here is they said, let's look into it. And they had an expert come before the Civil Service Board, actually send in information and material. And he said, look, this is very high adverse impact. We've seen it before, but this is on the high end of adverse impact. And there were a lot of things that were done in the creation of this test that raised questions about how good it is. For example, the test questions and so on were not reviewed by anybody in the New Haven Fire Department. They asked for review by other fire departments where conditions may have been different and the questions, therefore, may not have related directly to what was going on in New Haven. The oral versus written component was questionable because most people in the field know that oral comprehension and oral ability is much more important than written because a firefighter on the job doesn't write. He doesn't send his messages to his colleague, bring the hose over here, in writing. Right. He's got to be clear orally. So the expert said, look, this would have had less adverse impact and been more valid had the ratio of oral to written been higher.
Right. Instead of 60...
40, another town had used 70-30 with much better results.
70-30 oral.
Oral, yeah.
Versus written.
Exactly.
Right. I read that outside consultants created the exam. Do you know who those outside consultants were?
Well, the outside consultants that they use is some organization called IOS. I don't really know them, but I know that there are many in the field who create these tests, and the easiest kind of tests to create are these written exams. For firefighters.
Yeah, for firefighters.
But around the country, people are recognizing that these exams are not as valid as they should be. They tend to skew the outcomes very much in favor of whites because of written comprehension skills, which are rated very low by firefighters and by supervisors in terms of their importance for the job. They're rated very low. Oral comprehension is rated very high. So that was a point that the expert made. And finally, the expert said, look, there are overall just better ways of doing this. There are assessment techniques where you actually have the firefighters respond to some kind of a situation that's real. And you test them on that. You actually have them do some performance thing that relates to their jobs.
Now I want to bring you around, Richard, to two points. One is what's going to happen to the guys in New Haven now or the test? And then secondly, to the case that you're heavily involved in right now, the case against the New York City Fire Department. So let's first just quickly, what's going to happen now to the firefighters in New Haven?
Well, we don't know exactly how this is going to play out finally. But one thing that could happen is that these white firefighters will get these jobs and the city may be exposed to some litigation on the other side. Now, the Supreme Court has suggested that the city can defend itself because it didn't have the strong basis in evidence to set aside the test. But it will just mean a perpetuation of the white dominance, extraordinary dominance in that department. One thing we should observe about this test, by the way, which is a real black mark on the court in a way, because something they did here is extremely dishonest, in my view. And that is, they did not send this case back to New Haven or back to the lower court to review the evidence under the new standard or allow the parties to present evidence in light of the new standard.
That's what I was going to say. When I asked the question, I assumed that what would happen is this case would go back and the city or the plaintiffs would have a right to show that there was strong basis in evidence for saying this test didn't work.
Right. And that's exactly...
And they didn't allow that to happen.
They didn't allow that to happen. And what that shows is, more than anything else, that this was a result-oriented decision. In other words, the court didn't want these white firefighters to lose.
It's extraordinary when you say that.
Or to even be exposed to the possibility of loss, because what should have happened here, and Justice Ginsburg dwells on this to some extent, is when you set up a brand new rule in the Supreme Court that never existed before, you send the case back to the district court, and you say, hey, district court, you didn't know this, but we have a new standard now. Strong evidentiary basis must be shown before you can set a test aside. So let the parties now present evidence that might meet that standard. And the city of New Haven probably could have put in a whole lot more evidence, but didn't initially because the standard was much lower. They didn't think they had to, and that was right.
Wow, that's amazing. No, that's amazing. It makes you really feel... You got some very bad people sitting on the Supreme Court. That's what I would say from hearing that.
They're completely result-oriented, yeah. And they are extraordinarily activist. I mean, one of the things you observe when you read a decision like this is that, you know, this whole activism brand that's been put on liberal justices, it's completely the reverse. I mean, here you have all of the so-called liberal judges— Right, Stevens and Ginsburg, Souter and Breyer. These judges are basically advocating for the status quo. They're advocating for what has been the law for the last 40-something years, since Griggs, since 1971, an earlier case that decided, you know, that facially neutral practices could violate Title VII. You have a result-oriented outcome. You have an activist right-wing bench changing the law, and you have an extraordinary situation where they don't allow the parties to present their evidence in light of the new law.
Richard, we want to talk about your case with CCR, but in a nutshell, before we do that, can you tell us what does this decision do to Title VII if somebody's trying to explain it to another person on the street?
I think the main thing that it does to Title VII is make it very hard for individuals to work out or organizations to work out settlements of cases, and it makes it harder for employers to do the right thing, which is to look at their hiring practices and make independent judgments themselves that devices that they're using may violate Title VII and they should change them because they now will be exposed to possible litigation from whites or whatever the majority group is, that changing the selection procedure discriminated against them and that the employer can't establish a strong basis in evidence for making that change.
So, Richard, now let's bring you into your New York City firefighters case. Give people some of the percentages and then I know and where we are in the litigation and what effect, if any, this case might have.
Well, as compared to the New Haven case, the New York case should be a shoo-in. In New Haven, it's interesting. In the New Haven case, which has drawn all this controversy and has become an important Supreme Court decision, the city is roughly 40% black in New Haven. And the fire department is only 30% black, and it's been noted that that is a significant difference. And it was one of the things that I think was considered by the city when they wanted to set aside the test. Now let's turn to New York City. In New York City,
really.
The black population is somewhere between 25 and 30%. It's estimated at 27 or 28, depending on which way you read. The fire department has approximately 3% black incumbency.
Whenever you hear that number, you're just stunned.
It's extraordinary.
In a northern city. That's not true probably in most southern cities.
It's completely extraordinary.
That's 3% fire department blacks in New York in a population of 27%. So it's 9 times underrepresented.
Right. It's an amazing statistic. And, of course, that first prong of the adverse impact.
But they give an exam, right?
They give an exam.
In New York.
And right. And the exam in New York, which the Center for Constitutional Rights is challenging, and my law firm, Levy Ratner, is challenging, is a test that was used in 1999 and 2002 and modified somewhat in 2006. But that test was, first of all, entirely a written test. I shouldn't say that. There was a physical component, but there was no oral component. In other words, besides having the basic physical skills, the test is basically written comprehension, which was in the Supreme Court case that we just discussed in New Haven, was recognized that oral component is absolutely essential, and New York hadn't done that at all. And by the way, to this day, still doesn't do it. But in the city case, we should point out, first of all, the Justice Department has come into that case as well. So it's the Center and the Vulcan Society, which is a black organization of firefighters that brought this case initially and, in fact, started the whole action at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission back several years ago. And the Justice Department agreed that the city clearly discriminates in the use of this test, and so they also are in this litigation. I don't think the Supreme Court case affects this case at all. First of all, right now there's no settlement out there, and the case is before a judge who should decide on the record that the city has violated Title VII, because the record is overwhelming. I mean, it's much more than the standard that he has is different than the standard the Supreme Court enunciated, because the Supreme Court case had to do with what an employer can do when it voluntarily sets aside a test. In this case, the question is, have the plaintiffs, the Vulcan Society, established that there was an adverse impact, that blacks and Latinos did much worse than whites? And that question, as in the New Haven test, is clear. I mean, there's no question that the test discriminated on that level. And so then the question became, was the test required by business necessity? Well, the test, let me put it to you this way. The city submitted 3 pages of evidence in an attempt to show that the test was valid. Nowhere in those 3 pages does it say that the test is valid or required by business necessity. Now, when I say the 3 pages, that's their expert report. That's their expert report.
And what did you put in, Richard?
Between the Justice Department and the Vulcan Society, represented by CCR in my office, there were 4 expert reports submitted, varying in length. I don't remember the exact pages, but from 40 to 90 pages, basically showing that the test was a complete disaster. It only tested written material. It didn't test for a lot of things that even couldn't be tested for in writing, like things about judgment and things about personality that have an awful lot to do with whether you're going to be a successful firefighter. It only tested for certain cognitive skills. By the way, not even all the cognitive skills that were identified as being important. And in light of the discussion we had a moment ago about the importance of oral versus written skills, the New York City test didn't test anything orally, even though all parties seem to agree that oral comprehension and oral facility is verbal facility is important.
I still have, as we've talked about this case over the years, I've never quite gotten over the statistic and why the city hasn't tried to do something about that. This is it's a northern city. It's 27% black. We have many, many black politicians, many Latino politicians. Why does our fire department continue to be probably one of the more racially segregated departments in the United States?
Well, that's a really good question. And one aspect of the case is a claim by the Vulcans that the city intentionally discriminates. Now, in this particular case, I think intentional discrimination may mean just a willful disregard for what is obviously before them. In other words, it's been perfectly clear for many, many years that the fire department had virtually no black incumbents. It's been perfectly clear that the tests they use were these written tests, written cognitive tests that discriminated against all minority groups. And the issue has been raised for many years by the Vulcans. In fact, there was a lawsuit on this in 1973 that the Vulcans won. It's been raised many times with the mayor, with the fire commissioner, in direct face-to-face meetings with the Vulcans' leadership. They are just unwilling, generally, to acknowledge when they've made a mistake or done something wrong. They circle the wagons and they defend. And it's very hard to understand why. Now, they did give another test after the two that are challenged here that is, to be fair, better. But it's not good. It still has no oral component. It's still all entirely a written test. It still has no assessment mechanism of the kind they were talking about in the Ricci case. It's still a very backward exam in terms of trying to do something that's required by business necessity and treats all racial groups fairly.
So what's going to be the outcome, Richard? I know you're in the middle of the litigation.
The outcome, without question, should be that the judge should grant summary judgment in favor of the Vulcan Society here.
It's essentially giving you a victory trial.
Yes, they really should do that because the evidence is overwhelming. It's some of the top experts in the country pointing out in these very lengthy and very well-supported expert reports that the test fails on many, many levels. It's not representative of the job. It's poorly constructed. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do. There are many, many levels on which this test fails. And given that, there were numerous alternatives, even some that were used by New Haven here, it doesn't seem possible, really, that a logical adjudication of this question based on all the evidence that's been presented could lead to anything but a decision in favor of the Vulcans.
Well, Richard, I know you've been at this for years, so thank you very, very much. It does remind me of if we saw this fire department in Selma or Birmingham, we would say, what are we talking about? This is discrimination. So I think we can say the same thing here.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.